Right, and we're going to get into... So first off, let's see how to start. First up, how many of you guys are here having a good time?
Looks like everybody.
What?
Okay. All right, who's here not having a good time?
Yay.
Wow. No. What?
Are we talking the weather?
What's wrong with the weather?
Oh, the weather? Yeah.
No.
Have you never been to Georgia before?
Yeah, I don't think the weather has a badge, so if you see it in the hotel, please kick it out. Yeah. Great. So, among other things, we'll be discussing this group that I've helped to form called NIM Rights, and we'll get into what that is in a moment. But if you're interested in it, we have this magical clipboard. Well, maybe pass that around. That's going around. So, feel free to enter your email address, and if you have a NIM, and we'll get into what a NIM is in a bit here, feel free to add that too. And we're trying to get a whole bunch of people to participate to, among other things, protect free speech, anonymity, pseudonymity, things like that on the internet. So I guess we could just do introductions. Do you want to go first? Oh, okay. I get stuck with it all, huh? So let's see. Hi, everyone. I am Aesthetics, and I have helped form this group called NIM Rights. And I'll just do a basic introduction, and I guess we can then go through and give longer presentation type stuff. I have a few slides up, as you can see, and we're going to go through what I consider some of the foundations of these things so that we can have terminology and definitions before we start to get into the deeper questions. So when somebody asks about an example, what about this, we can point back to the definitions and things will start to hopefully coalesce and make sense. So,
okay, my name's Gitech. I'm currently the lead researcher at torrentfreak.com. I'm also governor of the UK Pirate Party, former leader of the U.S. Pirate Party and Pirate Parties International, as well as the legislation director for the U.S. Pirate Party. I'm also the co-editor and publisher of No Safe Harbor, a book on Pirate Party essays, which includes a very nice essay on the rights, pseudonym rights. So you can download the ebook version for free at nosafeharbor.com.
Hi. I'm Sarah Downey. I'm the only one up here who's not using a NIM. But I mean, as we'll get into, names come in all shapes and sizes, but this is my legal name. But I have a lot of pseudonyms that I'll get into once we start talking. So I'm a lawyer and I work at an online privacy company called Abine. And I like to play video games and I like to lift weights. And I actually read Andrew Kotek's book, and I signed up to register for the Pirate Party after reading it, so I recommend it. And I have a lot of experience with deleting things from the internet, which is harder than it sounds, but there are ways of going about it. I just did a talk about it in this very room this morning, so that's sort of my background. Oh yeah, and drinking. I gave my intro earlier, and I included copious amounts of drinking, which I will be doing tonight, hopefully.
Great. And this is so fantastic. I think we have an hour and a half, which is a good half hour longer than we... What?
About an hour.
What?
And we've got a half hour to switch over.
Oh, okay. Boo, I thought we'd have... Oh, anyways, we can do a bunch of stuff. Okay, great. So actually, first off, how many people recognize the picture up on the screen? Because... Okay, wow, so I just gave a talk in Holland, and the title of it was The Secret of NIM, NYM, you know, pun on it. Yeah, you guys all smile, you get it. Apparently Europeans have never seen that movie.
I haven't.
Yeah, so that caught me. What? Well, you're a weirdo.
I'm British, so.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. So, let's get started. How many people recognize this? It's the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, and let me just highlight a few key pieces here. Congress shall make no law, blah blah blah, respecting the freedom of speech, abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or of the right of the people to peaceably assemble. So, who can tell me where that comes from? Really?
Magna Carta, isn't it?
What? Well, I mean, what document does this what?
The Bill of Rights.
Bill of Rights. Okay, and Bill of Rights, which is part of the Constitution. Who here knows where the Constitution comes from? So, ready for a little history lesson? This is fun. So, before we had the Constitution, and this is the fundamental foundations of the United States, we had this thing called the Articles of Confederation. And it was the United States of America, but it was a bunch of states with really heavy states' rights with a very weak central federal government. And it turned out that this really didn't work out so well. So they went back to the drawing board and spent a whole bunch of time trying to figure out, well, how can we do this in a way that will really, really work? And they came up with what we now know as the Constitution. So there were two feuding groups here. There were the Federalists. On the left side there is Hamilton, Jay, and Madison. Are you going to point it out? And this comes up a lot in NIM discussions, the Federalist Papers, which were written in newspapers and things like that, to basically try to support the ratification of the Constitution. And they were all written under the pseudonym of Publius. So that was really interesting. So that was in support of a strong federal government as we have in the Constitution. So in opposition to that were the Anti-Federalist Papers, or the people who were basically opposed to a strong federal government and thought that government having too much power would cause all kinds of problems infringing on individual rights and states' rights and things like that. And by the way, this is an issue we're still fighting, states versus federal rights versus individual rights and whatnot, as we have seen with the NSA and PRISM and things like that. I think Sarah will probably get into more of that discussion. So, by the way, the Anti-Federalists were also using pseudonyms, including Brutus and a few other names. So we basically had these two sides of the argument, pro-strong central government and anti-strong central government, having a really open and honest discussion back and forth with each other. And all of them were using pseudonyms. And after lots of discussion, they came to this compromise, something that DC really should think about more, called the Bill of Rights. And that's where it comes from, because the Constitution itself, it gives a lot of power to the federal government, and then the Bill of Rights comes around and protects the people from the government. So one of the reasons, in my opinion, that the First Amendment is the first is because it protects the freedom of speech. And without freedom of speech, we wouldn't have had the discussion which led to the formation of our country in the first place. So those are some really interesting things to think about as we get deeper into this. And this brings us into the next thing that's kind of foundational. Within the identity community, there's this notion of attribution. And you can usually describe attribution as, I see on the left side there, there is a painting in a museum, and that little placard on the right or whatnot, it's the label. So if you use Flickr and you see a photo that was taken by somebody, or you're in a museum and you see a painting and this was done by somebody, what you're doing is attributing who that is to. And this gets into ownership and other things like that. So on the right hand, you have the origin of a lot of really interesting attribution challenges that we've had, the printing press. So before I go further, who can tell me what was the first book printed on the printing press?
Bible.
Okay. Who can tell me the second most popular thing that was printed on the printing press? Anyone? I'll give you a hint. 1517. That was 1215. Close, though. But no, 95 Theses by Martin Luther. And there's a couple of reasons that's significant. And one of the reasons that I think it spread so much is because it was heresy at the time. And turns out that people are really interested in heresy. Go figure, right? And four? What's that?
I hear it's a good beer.
Oh, yeah, it's a good beer, too. So there's a couple of important things to note here, because before you had the printing press, what the printing press does, it enables widespread distribution of something. I take a manuscript and I write it up, and I put it on the printing press, and suddenly I have 1,000 copies. I don't have to go and like write 1,000 copies by hand. And that suddenly makes things much more difficult to control, in a sense. And you get, and a lot of the copyright issues we have now are because of the precedents that were set by the printing press, because once you have something, how do you prevent things like copyright infringement? How do you make sure that a person who wrote a book really wrote it? Voltaire is an example I've used in the past. He wrote the book Candide, and the king of France wanted to kill the person who wrote the book because it was a huge satire on the government. So these are just some of the interesting things that come into play. And there's two elements, now that we've considered that, to attribution: reputation and accountability. And both of them have become really, really big questions as the internet has permeated through society. So with reputation, how do you know something is valid? How do you know something is worthwhile? So do you go based on, for example, with Twitter, do you go based on the number of followers somebody has, or the fact that they have that little Twitter icon thing for a verified Twitter account? Or on a Yelp review, how do you know that the review that is there is worthwhile, things like that. And an accountability, if somebody commits a crime, how do you catch them? How do you bring them to justice? So those are two kind of critical key components of all of this. And this leads into another question, which is, does free speech necessitate anonymous speech? And this is something we've really been digging into with anonymous culture and basically all the internet stuff that's been going on right now. And one of the things I wanted to point to, are you familiar with this case, by the way, the McIntyre case?
Mm-hmm. So, I cite that shit a lot.
Yeah, so actually everyone has been. Basically every internet case relating to online identity or anonymous and basically compelling somebody to give up their legal name and things like that, everybody is citing that Supreme Court case, which is McIntyre versus Ohio Elections Commission. The interesting thing is it's from 1995, and there really aren't that many First Amendment court cases in the United States, but that one is really important. So that's getting... trying to think. Should I go into detail on what it is? Or?
Yeah.
Okay. So there was a woman. She was passing out basically political... Oh, wow. We got a whole bunch of signups. Great. So there was a woman, Miss McIntyre. She was passing around, I think it was political brochures of some sort in Ohio. And I believe she was arrested because the flyers themselves did not have a name on them. They didn't say who she was. They didn't say the organization it was part of. And this was taken all the way to the Supreme Court because she thought that she should have a right to publish these flyers, these brochures and pamphlets, without attribution on them. And one of the lines I quote a lot, I believe the majority opinion by Justice John Paul Stevens in this case, had the quote, "Anonymity is a shield from the tyranny of the majority." And this is something that has been coming up a lot. Like, basically, as I said, pretty much every case that we're seeing right now is citing that. So, now let's get into some of the internet stuff. And how many people here are familiar with NimWars? So, how many of you are familiar with Google Plus? Wow, okay. So
you're all the users of Google Plus then?
Yeah, this whole room.
Fair enough. Okay, so you're all familiar with it and all the drama that's going around with Google. I want to focus, though, on... So when Google Plus was first released, and this was a couple of years ago now, this was the summer of... what's that?
2 years?
It was 2 years ago. Yeah, it was the summer of 2011. Because I got suspended in, like, July, I think, maybe August, something like that. So what happened was people were jumping to this thing because we all really loved Google at the time, and... everyone was getting upset at this, like, Facebook, and there were some really big issues going on, and some of it was with their privacy settings and things like that, and we're like, well, Google can come and save the day. And all these people who I knew jumped onto Google Plus, and shortly after, all these people I knew began getting their accounts suspended. And that's a problem. So, does anybody here know somebody who's had an account suspended from Google, by the way? Okay, and... there's a few. Okay. Actually, if you can come chat with me afterwards, one of the projects I'm working on is trying to document everyone who's been suspended by an internet website. We'll get into that in a little bit. So what that turned into is all these people who are saying, wait a second, this is my name. And Google was demanding government-issued IDs and saying that you must have your quote-unquote real name. Facebook has a policy like that, too. A number of sites do. And there was a lot of question, people saying, well, I've been using this name for 20 years. It's not a legal name, but it sure as hell is real, and it's nobody would recognize me if I put John Smith up on a Google or a Facebook profile or something like that. And it turned into what became known as the NIM Wars, NYM Wars. And the purpose of it ultimately was to try to bring a bunch of people fighting against Google to see if Google could change their ways. And just so you guys know, there is one person at Google who is in charge of the Google Plus Real Names policy, and it's all on him, and I've never met him, but he's a douchebag from what I can tell. His name is Vit Gundotra. He is the Google executive in charge of Google Plus. And I've talked to a lot of people at Google, and all of them point to him, and there's actually been an exodus from Google because of him. So, or more specifically, because of the names policy, some other architectural changes that have happened within Google. So, in any case, when trying to explain what the challenge with this was, I decided we could come up with a diagram like this, and this is what I call Google's method. So, at the top, and notice it's hierarchical, it's top down, and you think of top, you think of levels like, you know, better, middle, like not as good, things like that. And you have real name, which is going to be driver's license, and I was asked for my government issued, I was actually asked for a driver's license type thing from Google, and then I started to question their data retention policy practices, and they went ahead and reinstated my account. And a class below. So it's like first class citizens is the real names users, and then the second class citizens are those with the pseudonyms. And you can see it's the pseudonym that is facing on your Twitter or your Facebook or, you know, whatever else you do. And the caption, I don't know if you can see it from the back here, but it says, "Labels give someone else power over you." And if you think about words and the nature of words, that kind of captures a lot of meaning. So, and also I want to point out, do you guys know the origin of the word legitimate? It's from the Latin legitimare, it means to make lawful. So if you think about that in context of what's going on here, there's some really weird power dynamics going on. So first thing I want to address is I have a big issue with the term real name. I think it is bullshit. And first off, what's the opposite of real? Anyone?
Fake, false.
Okay, well, I heard virtual. That was interesting.
Yeah.
Like Second Life type stuff. But usually I hear fake or unreal or not as good as, things like that, again, with the classes and hierarchies. So there's a lot of negative implications with the notion that you have one real name, one true name, the true name of God, things like that, the names your parents gave you and such. And that means that if you're using some other kind of name, are you trying to get away from something? Are you trying to hide? And that gets into like murky shadow-like territory very quickly. And I think that's actually really counterproductive and not useful. So the second I see is a lack of agency. So how many people here chose their legal names? How many people here have a name that they have chosen that they use? A few more, okay. Slowly the hands come up. So you don't really have a choice over it. And when you're talking about personal agency and individual ability and the ability to express yourself the way that you choose, agency is really important. So that's something to consider. And the challenge is, well, you can't take down a system without rebuilding it with something else. And it turns out, I think that there are some really good replacements for the phrase real name. I would say legal name, because if it's on a driver's license or a passport or a state ID or a voter registration card or something like that, that's lawful. And one of the things that I tell everyone is that I will not show ID unless there is a law requiring it. And that throws a few people off, and maybe it'll make them think about it. And I think that's a good thing, ultimately. What? That was an interesting conversation. They didn't really like being taught about NIM stuff when I got in at like 11 o'clock at night. But at least they learned something, right? So it's easily substituted with alternatives. So legal name is one, birth name is one, so a name on your birth certificate, or given name, family name sometimes comes up. And all of those carry what I consider to be positive affiliations. Real, I don't really consider very positive, but family, I think family is a good thing, a community name, a legal name, it shows you're a lawfully abiding citizen living within the rule of society and such. And given name also means somebody cared enough about you to give you a name to begin with. And there's also a question of where the concept comes from. And there are a number of theories on this. It's really hard. The earliest I've been able to trace down is, I think it was Henry II in the formation of English common law in like the 1200s, when they were trying to create the court system. Previous to common law, have you studied that stuff at all? So previous to common law, there were scattered like colonies all through England. And I think Henry II was the first who began going around to all of them and really unifying them under a common law. Now, once you begin to have common law, before you had these tiny communities where everyone basically knew each other by name. And once you start to keep things in a centralized depository, you have to be able to keep track of things like property rights, you know, who owes who, titles are, things like that. So there's a lot of trackability and a lot of attribution issues that begin to come up. And there's actually, if you guys are interested in pursuing the history of names more, I recommend there was a talk at 28C3. It's a conference in Germany in the CCC called, yes, Chaos Computer Club. And it was called What Is in a Name? And I think the person who gave it was Chris Engman. And it was a fantastic talk. Goes into the history of the Catholic Church and the Reformation and the discovery of the New World and things like that. So let me move on so I can give the other panelists a chance to speak a bit. So here is kind of a draft for identity that I've come up with. And the middle thing there, it's the yin-yang. It's like the Jungian identity of emotional and rational and things like that. And what I'm showing here is that you yourself are what I would call a system, right? And then you have Twitter, which I would also say is a system, and Facebook is also a system. And what's going on here is that rather than having this structured hierarchy where you're being given a name of some sort by, like, a granting authority, or as we might call it in the identity community, an identity provider. You instead have these systems and their relationships within the systems. And the caption there, if you can't see it, is labels help to define relationships. So, for example, between Twitter, you have a relationship with Twitter, and I consider that name that you have there, in this case it would be like Johnny X, because he's one of the people at Dragon Con.
The science track director.
Yes, he's the science track director. He's a crazy guy. Ask him about Discordianism sometime. In any case, what you're seeing there is a relationship and then a label which describes the relationship. And one of the reasons that I have this set up like this is because relationships are multifaceted, and they can be two ways. So, for example, there may be consent issues, maybe trust, things like that. All of them, you have to have a relationship with something or someone before you can enter the ideas of trust and consent and basically what name you choose to use. So another thing I want to point out here is that I've got them labeled A, B, C, and D. For C right there, the name John Smith is the name that describes the name on, say, your driver's license or your relationship with the government. In this case, it would be a state government. A passport would be with the federal government. So the interesting thing here with the D, that's the name your friends and family call you, and this is kind of just an example, but the word nickname literally means an additional name. So what we're getting there is, if your name is John Smith, and then the name that your friends and family call you is Jack, that name is effectively derived from the name that's on your ID. So therefore, it is a nickname or an additional name to it. So an additional derivation, things like that. So I find that this model is really helpful, and if any of you are computer programmers or anything like that, think about this next time you're crafting an identity model for your website or your company or something. So I think I'm getting near the end, but I want to first put out a bunch of definitions. What is a NIM? So pseudonym, for example, here, it's a name that is used to hide a base name. And an important element I want to show here is that a pseudonym implies that there are two names, right? You have the base name, which might be a legal name, and the pseudonym would be a name you use at Dragon Con, for example. But there's two names involved there, so it's basically the base name. So it's, again, structured hierarchy. Then you have polynym, which is a name consisting of multiple words or symbols, so it could be your first and last name if you have two, or the example I've used is, say John Smith is your polynym, you know, it's multiple names or symbols, and then a mononym could just be John. It could just be, I have a friend, he's a mononym, Sai, that's his full legal name, S-A-I. Really nice guy. And below that you have an autonym, which this is kind of analogous to autonomy, which autonomy is self-rule, self-regulation and such. So autonym is a name that you bestow upon yourself, which is different from a pseudonym, because it's not trying to hide anything, it's not trying to conceal, it simply exists as its own base name. And our current society seems to have an issue with people that have multiple base names. And we can get into more things like that in the questions. And an anonym is a name that represents anonymity. So the example I've used, do you guys use Slashdot at all? Okay, that might be dated, but basically, or anonymous, how about anonymous, right? Everyone, anonymous, yeah. What? Well, I'm just saying, it's a name that's supposed to represent anonymity in a sense, when in fact it's representing this core of a group, and everyone is called anonymous. Therefore, to people who are not inside of the group, they appear to be one and the same. It creates some semblance of anonymity. So in some sites, if you like leave a comment on Slashdot, for example, without logging in, then it just brands you as an anonymous coward. I would call an anonymous coward an anonym. So there you go. And just running over some quick projects that I've got going on. So nimrights.org is the website that we're keeping track of a lot of the stuff at. So we have the suspended project. It's kind of inspired by Wendy Seltzer's Chilling Effects. It's basically listing off, I'm beginning to collect a list of people who have been suspended by internet services, and also if they have their own testimonials. So for example, people have posted the emails they've had exchanged with Google+, things like that. So this is kind of a new project, and it's ongoing work in process. So if any of you have stories, please come up and share. So another project that we're working on right now. So Google+ has the names policy, right? And it applies to anybody who has a Google account that's using it. But the interesting thing is that a Google app, because a Google app is designed for a company that wants to basically allow their employees to use it, and companies set their own policies, with Google Apps, you can set your own policies that users will agree to. So I'm working with Dazzy Greenwood from MIT. He's from the MIT Media Lab on this project we're calling omnivisual.com. There's not a website up there yet. It's still just the generic server. But what we have done, we've created our own draft NIM policy to kind of contrast with like the Google and the Facebook and all those other policies. And also the policy is stored in GitHub, so anybody can make changes or recommendations, and we want to have a public discussion about it. And that policy is going to be the rule of law for the system that we're setting up, which is going to be integrated with Google+. So we're basically facing two policies against each other to see what will happen. And if Google decides to do something like, oh, I don't know, suspend one of the users' accounts, well, Daz is a lawyer with MIT, so we'll see what happens with that. So, like I said before, there's these things called identity providers, which, as you can probably imagine, is a system or a service which grants an identity or provides an identity. Social Security number might be considered one of those, so the Social Security Administration could be an identity provider. Although the identity community doesn't seem to really have a good definition of what the word identity means. That's another rant altogether. So I figured having a NIM-friendly identity provider to prove that it works and to try to dispel some of the myths that are going on could be incredibly positive. So last thing here, NIMrights.org, join NIMrights, please, if this did not completely bore you to death. And also, there is a government project that we can get into in a bit. It's NSTIC, or National Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace, where I'm directly working with people from the government, including the Obama administration. It's sponsored by NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, on trying to craft a policy so that as we bring a lot of these services onto, a lot of government services onto the internet, namely things like, how do you file your taxes? What if you need to file for unemployment or collect Social Security or access your health records, things like that? They're trying to come up with some kind of a federated identity system, so we've joined to make sure that they don't fuck us over. So if you want to help troll NIST, it should be lots of fun. And as you can see, I'm a member there under aesthetics, and I took this screenshot to demonstrate that it was possible. It turned out somebody had actually, what's the guy's name? Snertly. I have no idea who that was, but this inspired somebody else to come and join, too. And a few other people have joined since. It is free, and you also do not have to be a U.S. citizen if you have concerns about that. And if you want to put your email on this list, I can email you instructions on how to join. It's very, very low effort, and we're all really friendly. Well, at least I am. I try to be most of the time. Well, we won't. What's that? Indeed. All right, so I think that's most of what I have right now. So I guess I can pass the conch to you.
Sure.
All Hopefully right. I didn't take up all the time. I really thought I'd keep that under 15 minutes.
Sorry, I'm messing with dongles right now.
Dongle? I'm offended. Does somebody have an Instagram account that we can shame you? Well, she said enough. Does anybody have questions so far?
So if you're registering...
Hang on a second. Let's get a microphone to you. Oh,
okay.
Does it work now? Sort of. A little more. Okay. So if you're registering NIMs of everyone, this means you're creating a chain of accountability for them.
What do you mean by registering NIMs?
Well, I'm assuming you haven't finished yet. I'm assuming that makes me a cunt. I'm sorry, but. You're trying to make it where only one person can have one, NIM for who represents them, because otherwise you have, 20 people going around saying, I'm the Wolf Tamer 22 or whatever. How do you file that back to one person for either credit and or liability?
Right. I can answer that, but do you want to speak on that at all, or...?
You can handle that.
Okay, I'll handle that. So, there's a couple things. First off, I don't think that people should be limited to a single NIM. Second, I think that what it sounds like you're getting at with the accountability issue is the impersonation issue, and a lot of websites actually have Clinton. So, for example, earlier this year, after Instagram was acquired by Facebook, Instagram began suspending people that, I guess, I don't even know if it was because of the names that they were using, but that they were suspending people and demanding government-issued ID, and the process they were justifying it was impersonation. And that is challenging, and the question is not so much... So, like, with identity fraud, the challenge is not that you're assuming somebody's identity, the challenge is that you're doing fraud with their identity. So it's not the assumption of a name so bad as the fact that you are doing a violation of trust or you are breaking a law with it. So in terms of accountability for that, if they break a law, like say you do financial fraud or impersonation of a credit card number or something like that, there are laws that work with that, that, how to put it, it is a legal issue, and I'm completely okay with accountability for legal issues. Now, the question about whether the law itself is justified, that's very different. In terms of a social issue, I think that's something that should be settled within the social group itself. So does that answer your question at all?
Sort of.
Okay. How can I clarify for you?
All right. So if I'm understanding everything that's been presented so far, we're trying to make it where you can have a name and use it as more or less a given name. If you're going to introduce yourself to someone or within a community or mm-hmm. whatever, you use that, and that is you. But what do you do with conflicts in between? So let's say, you know, you still have two people, but they have the same handle.
Right.
But they're both, you know, no one's doing anything bad, but who gets that credit for work that they spent time on and they did work with?
Don't we have that problem already with legal names as it is? I mean, that's one of the reasons behind why I use it, because my legal name is so common that even searching it with DragonCon wouldn't narrow it down, because it matches some very, very famous authors. So even with, you know, book and DragonCon, that it still provides a you know, overlap with people. And so,
well, like my legal name is pretty uncommon, and I am the only one with my last name here.
Fair enough. Well, the other thing that I would add to that is names are very much dependent on context, and name collisions within context. So there's a few things here. Within any context, as a context grows, so for example, if you have a community and the community grows over time, it becomes more and more difficult to do this. I have in the past mentioned things like having a small tribal community or something. Does everyone here know about Dunbar's number, for example? Does anybody? Okay, so Dunbar's number is a phenomenon. Dr. Robin Dunbar did a study, I think in like 92 or something, studied groups of primates and found there was a direct correlation between the size of a primate's brain and the social group that it had. So mathematically, bringing that logic to us, Homo sapiens sapiens, found that that number was about 150, somewhere between 120 and 150, and there have actually been a couple of follow-up studies with Facebook that found that most people have that many friends. So as you scale beyond a group of about 150, and that's D-U-N-B-A-R is Dunbar's number, as you scale beyond a group of that size, this does get really tricky, which is why in a lot of places, instead of having one group that scales out like that, you have to have, like a company, for example, a startup will eventually segment into like smaller groups, because it is simply psychologically impossible for us to keep track of that many people. So if I have two people who are both Dave Brown, if the context is small enough, I got the Dave Brown with blue hair and the Dave Brown with black hair. So there are other ways besides names that we can add in and individuate, or maybe the night shift and the day shift Daves, something like that. Mm-hmm. Yes.
You've obviously thought very particularly about the specificity of the terms mm-hmm. that you're using in this ongoing discussion. And there's one point of clarification that I'd like,
sure.
which is, are you advocating with the creation of NIMS and NIM culture literally a divorcement of a person from their name? Like, I could have a NIM or a name, and there would literally be no way to track that back to this guy who's sitting here.
Right, so that gets into a couple of things. And number one, I don't think it's possible to do that. So let's say I try to access a website anonymously. Even if I'm using Tor or something, you have all kinds of, shall I say, metadata that you can use to track somebody. So access time, what pages they went to, profiles they visited, things like that. So I don't think it's possible to do that. What I'm really getting at is attempting to explain to people that people use NIMS for all kinds of things, and it's not just for committing crimes. And my ultimate goal here is to make it so that NIMS are more socially acceptable to use, and that we don't have sites like Google and Facebook, which are on this paradigm shift to create, like, basically, the way that it looks, Google is trying to become its own identity provider. And you see this with the Airbnb case, for example, where Airbnb is allowing you to do online identity verification, where you get the little verification thing if you link your Airbnb account to Facebook or to LinkedIn. And
Just clearing my throat.
Okay. So the answer is it's complicated, and I don't think there's any kind of divorcing that should happen, because really I think a NIM is just as much a part of you as a legal name. And I think some people have multiple NIMs, depending on how many different contexts they go to. Does that answer the question at all?
My only concern would be the absolute removal of any accountability, the perfect anonymity of someone. That's, I'm sure there's a long, complex discussion to be had there, but that strikes me as something that has some very dangerous.
Absolutely, yes. And that's why I included accountability in the discussion here. I don't think there is any such thing as full anonymity, because anonymity implies, basically, when I said the whole thing about the relationships that you have between entities, anonymity would basically be permeated on the relationship that you have with somebody. So you have to get into the question of what anonymity is, or more specifically, what information about me goes out to somebody else. So the challenge with anonymity is, can you be anonymous to yourself, for example, if you consider yourself to be like a social group of one? How can you yourself have no name? Although no name itself becomes a name. So I don't actually think there is such a thing as full anonymity, quote unquote, because there will always be metadata characteristics which tie in and help to individuate who somebody is. But there are ways in which you can protect yourself, or you can control the relationship that you have with others. Does that answer it better? Okay.
Cool.
Okay, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I think when we're talking about anonymity, though, I don't think that people are really seeking to divorce themselves from their identity. If you go back to the image that you demonstrated, it more has to do with that yin-yang person, that identity of an individual. Mm-hmm. And what you're trying to avoid is that your relationships in one network are trying to make some sort of presumption on your relationship with another network.
Right.
So you don't want perhaps your Twitter account to necessarily be able to interfere with your legal situation. So it seems to me that perhaps an ideal would be that you as an individual have some sort of GUID, some sort of globally universally unique identifier that identifies it to you, that you then can make relationships through whatever pseudonym is appropriate for the relationship. And then the trick is just being able to divorce each of the individual networks. Is this kind of an accurate understanding of your thesis?
So, I don't think there's any such thing as a universal identifier. And
right. I mean,
a lot of people think there is, and they're trying to do that. I also recommend looking up, my friend Kalia is doing this thing. She has this model called the identity spectrum, which kind of illustrates this in a different way than I have, which goes to that a bit. But I don't think it's about divorcing things. I think it's much more about allowing people to express who they are in a more open fashion. So you may have multiple contexts that you exist in, and it's about having the choice of whether you want those contexts to be merged together or not. It's about individual agency and individual choice, and what your relationship not only to that system, but how those systems work together for you is. So it's fundamentally about that. And there are people, like, I'm thinking Rob Scoble, who likes to whore himself all over the place. Okay, nobody's laughing, so it must be a Bay Area thing.
No, Scobalizer. Yeah.
Right, so yeah, you got people like Scoble, who doesn't give a shit and like wants to have all of his things linked together, including photos of him in the shower and things like that, which I really don't want to see, but whatever. Yep. So there's one other concept that I want to address here that I didn't have in the talk, and that's a persistent identity. Is anyone familiar with that term? So persistent identity, so let's say that I have two contexts. I have my account on Twitter and my account on Facebook, right? So there's two separately completely separate things. So I have my identity one is the Twitter one, identity two is the Facebook one. So persistent identity would be a like what you said, a universal identity, which persists across contexts. So when you're pulling in something like what Google and Facebook are doing, they're trying to assert some sort of persistent identity. And one of the reasons there's so much of a push for this, I think, is because there's a lot of money to be made into it. So for example, imagine that the government imposes a national identity on the United States, and well, there's got to be somebody to make those ID cards, right? Well, guess how many fucking large corporations are involved in this NISTIC stuff that I'm working with? So there's a lot of money to be made in it, but then you have to think about, well, wait, persistent identity, if there's some kind of a lawfully forced persistent identity on the internet, that takes away a whole lot of agency and rights. And there's, like, South Korea tried to pass a law about this back in 2003. They repealed it last year. China just passed a law about this about 6 months ago. And they're basically doing this internet registry thing where you have what would be, like, your social security number or something. Yes, an IPv6 address for everyone. There's some major issues with IPv6, too, but... What's that? But yeah, so a lot of this is about the notion of persistent identity and the understanding that it's actually important for people to have multiple contexts if they choose.
I think that online is choice.
Mm-hmm.
Your choice, not their choice.
Yeah. All right, you
want to
start your...
Sure, yeah.
That's okay. I can field these questions all day long.
I'll try to leave you some time. So I could tell you that the reason that I care about this stuff is because I'm a lawyer and I studied First Amendment and intellectual property and that I work for a privacy company, but really the reason why I care is because I used to have a fetish Q&A podcast under a pseudonym, and that was a very strong protector, and I had some issues with stalking, and really it was only the pseudonym that protected me and ultimately my family, because these people were kind of tireless and got my family involved. So I know firsthand how incredibly important it is to be able to choose who you are in which contexts. And it really bothers me that companies like Facebook and Google are aggressively trying to force us into one box all the time, because it benefits them. I mean, it's all about the money on the internet today is made in finding out who you are and what you're into so that they can sell you stuff. And although there's a great amount of free speech that happens online, and of course it's a great venue for that, this consolidation of identity threatens that. Also today I am dressed like Rogue from the X-Men, that is a pseudonym, and I thought this was appropriate today because they're like a whole team of pseudonymous mutants. Briefly to start out, the company that I'm at is called Abine. We just released a tool that sort of helps you be more pseudonymous online by creating masked or alias credit cards, emails, and phone numbers. So, have any of you heard of the site 23andMe? It's basically like Gattaca, the movie. Like, you spit in a jar, you send it into them, they send you back this dashboard, basically, that says, you know, you're more likely to get celiac disease. Like, I'm at elevated risk of breast cancer, I just found out from doing this.
Oh,
But I was able to do it with a fake name, fake credit card, fake address, fake email, phone, using a VPN, and so I'm pretty sure that this company doesn't know shit about me. I mean, they have my genome, but they don't know that it's me.
You get arrested and they take your DNA.
Yeah, well, that's an increasing thing. Identity verification through things like DNA. You know, they take a hair sample or at a crime scene and they can find out a whole lot about you. We're trying to make it easier for people to be pseudonymous online. Like, here's an example of, like, if you click into an email field when registering, you'll get this option. Like, do you want to disclose your real email or a fake one? And it will forward. I'm just going to talk sort of about a couple of interesting topics that I wanted to cover. I'm going to try to skip through some of them. NSA, I don't think we can skip because that's such a huge, huge deal right now with privacy and identity. It hasn't come up yet, surprisingly, but there's this prevailing argument that we need to track people and we need to know about them because terrorism and child porn, basically. And you've kind of danced around
for
this,
the children.
But... Yeah.
I noticed there aren't many kids here. Why is that?
Yeah. Well, It's a, I mean, it's really, yeah. You can't just allow people to say that and take away your civil liberties and your privacy. And there are plenty of reasons, obviously, why pseudonyms are important, not just for pedophiles, but also for general discourse online. I mean, you all know that you do things in the privacy of your own homes or in the car or behind closed doors that you wouldn't do if you were in front of your boss or your grandma or Congress. Like, knowing that you're being watched changes the way that you act and changes the things that you say, and you censor yourself. And at least for me, in the past 5 or so years, knowing all the tracking that's going on, like, I am intentionally boring on things like Facebook because I know that everything's being tracked. And it's like this mechanism for great speech that we have on the internet is, it's sort of crumbling a little bit the more you realize the extent of this tracking. And this is just a picture. You mentioned metadata. This is a picture of all the metadata that's associated with your email and your phone. And so actually before this, Aesthetics and I were getting food, and he had this great slide that he brought up of the game Guess Who, which is a perfect example of why metadata is important, because that's basically a game of metadata. You find out the person by asking questions about the details, like, do they have glasses? Do they have a red shirt? Is that a shirt or a background? And Guess Who? I never really knew. But you can figure out an individual by breaking down the pieces of data about them, like, you know, how tall they are, what eye color they have, where they were born, other public record information. So you really are the sum of your data. And so don't let anybody tell you that it's just metadata.
I'd say that you're greater than the sum of your data, but...
Well, yeah.
I don't want to get into that one.
I mean, there was actually a study in the journal Nature that found that only 4 pieces of very, very general metadata about your phone are enough to identify 96% of individuals. So these are like general cell tower pings. Like, where were you vaguely when you were carrying your phone, which is basically a GPS tracker in your pocket at all times. And, you know, that's how General Petraeus was uncovered. Email metadata. So, yeah.
Oh, the Petraeus.
I don't
really
want to get into
God.
That. I'm trying to move quickly. Facial recognition is becoming a bigger and bigger issue. We were talking about how there's not really a universal identifier. But your face is kind of the closest thing that you have to universal identifier, in that it goes with you everywhere. You can't change it unless you get seriously painful and expensive plastic surgery. And increasingly, it's going to be used to unmask and identify you wherever you go. Like, if I came here today and I decided to use a pseudonym, there is off-the-shelf software right now that one of you could have on your phone. You could take a picture of me. It could scan my face. Everybody has a face print, like a fingerprint. It's like, how far away are your eyes, and where's your mouth and nose? And it could identify me based on public record, Google image search type data that's out there, sync it up with things like LinkedIn and Facebook, get things like addresses. And there was a famous Carnegie Mellon study that actually showed that you can get a person's social security number through that. So, like, take a picture of someone in a bar, get their social security number. So this is what's happening. This is kind of where we're headed.
Oh, there's a new app that does that, too. They've been putting it in bars in the Bay Area.
SceneTap?
Oh, God, yes. That's caused so many problems.
Well, it's actually facial detection versus... This is what this slide is about. Facial detection is the cookie on the right, which is iPhoto. It thinks that it sees a face, so it tags that as unknown face. So it's a very mysterious bear cookie. And that's kind of the basis of apps like SceneTap, which are cameras that are being installed in bars across the country that scan the crowd, not to identify, not for facial recognition, which would recognize you particularly, but to detect if you are a guy or girl, rough age. So then you could log in with the app and see if it's a sausage fest at the bar before you go. See generally how old people are. So if it's like, all right, it's like a whole lot of cougars, I might want to go, you know? So so that's a,
yeah.
That's actually pretty innocuous as far as
hanging out with Harold and
Maude goes. Yeah. But yeah, your face is an identifier that essentially can strip away the use of or the purpose of having a name. I mean, I don't even have to give you my name if you take a picture of me and you can figure all that stuff out.
Can I bounce off of that for a second, actually? Because you within the facial recognition, so I know I discovered this in Oakland during one of the protests, because Oakland is famous for its protests, among other things. What? Protests and riots and anyways, yeah, I saw somebody get arrested for wearing a mask, and I'm like, what the fuck? And it turns out that actually quite a few states have laws. This is actually a local city law to Oakland, but
New
quite
York is one. New York's one as well.
Yeah, and from what I can tell, and these the laws are not super well documented. I can't really find the origins so well of them, but it turns out that a lot of places passed like laws banning wearing masks in public to stop the KKK from being active. Because they can't legally stop the KKK from doing rallies because there's free speech, but they decided to pass a law against masks. Whereas, in my opinion, a mask is actually a physical instantiation of a pseudonym because it's literally a mask covering another mask. Therefore, I think it's a free speech thing. So if somebody wants to help make case law out of that, let me know.
That'd be interesting, yeah.
So I just wanted... Interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Just follow Keanu Reeves and wear a mask that looks like the president's.
Yeah. Because of limited time, I'm not going to get into these. I'm just going to end with one approach, which is I talked a little bit about Facebook. I just want to make it perfectly clear that sites like Facebook are pushing incredibly hard to unmask you and get to the real you. You know, Mark Zuckerberg has this famous quote about pseudonymity where he says, I think pseudonyms show having multiple identities shows a lack of integrity. And actually, his sister was quoted saying, I think anonymity on the internet has to go away. So, like, let's be fully clear that this is a company and a mindset, not just with Facebook, but in tech companies across the world, that they want to know the real you. And just think hard about whether you want them to know the real you.
Do another pass and see if anybody else.
So I'm just gonna skip the rest of my stuff so that you can get started.
Oh yeah. Oh, so yeah, just if you guys came in late, we're passing this around. So enter your email address on there, and we will enlist you into the ranks. Yes.
Okay. Where's the mic?
Oh, you have a question while we get. What's? To repeat the question, what is the source behind this move to force people to use their legal names with? Right. My best answer is that's classified. I don't fucking know.
It really is worth that much money. It really is. I mean, like, we would have to guess at whether they had darker purposes, but the fact is there's almost no distinction between public and private surveillance. Like, you give your data voluntarily to Facebook. Facebook hands it over to the government out the back door in the thousands and thousands of requests every 6 months, you know? So it's really, that's a big issue, you know? Like, that's coming up in divorce cases. Like, for instance, somebody would want to claim that you're going to be a shitty parent and shouldn't get a kid, and they're going to pull up a private Facebook message where you talked about, like, drinking excessively. You know, that's probably the worst use of this kind of data. But the ad money is real, and increasingly things like your email or your phone are the link that tie your offline activity with your online activity. Like, you know how you get harassed every time you go to a retail counter for your email? Like, it's just for coupons. Sign up for a loyalty card. They take that data, sync it back to Facebook. So there's a lot of, like, back and forth tracking going on to know exactly what ads you saw online. Did you buy that thing offline? Where are you going? You know, phone data combination. So it's very pervasive and very, it makes a lot of money.
I just want to add one more thing before we got a bunch of questions. Yay for questions. When I mentioned in the very beginning the whole First Amendment thing and freedom of speech, keep in mind that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights specifically protects us from the government. It does not protect us from what corporations are doing, and more these corporations are acting like and as governments, and that's scary as shit to me. The fact that people are treating Google, Facebook, and everything else as a forum for public speech, when not only is it not, but the fact that something that you say can be subpoenaed without your knowledge, it can be used against you in many other ways, it can be censored, it can be taken without your permission because they fucking own it. Keep that in mind, that what you're really doing is feeding data into large corporations that treat you as cattle. Anyway.
Hi, thank you for your panel. In relation to one of the comments that, or points that was made earlier, would you say that then there's like a correlation relationship then between, on one hand, identity and privacy as to relating to freedom of speech and dissent, there, so that the loss of privacy could correlate in some way, in some form of relationship to a loss of ability to dissent?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
So, okay. So
like
I just
that's
one of the things I'm certainly hearing. And then
you say something bad about your company on Facebook and you get fired the next day. There you
go.
Or you go to a protest, right? And then like
there's
your photograph
also,
being there, and
there's also big money by like ISP providers and cell phone companies for actually handing over data. It's not a small chunk of quarterly profit.
And there's secret laws requiring them to.
Yes, because that's right. Because you have you can't just come in and take data. The government has to pay for it, and that's big money. But that wasn't really the point I was going to make. Is what if people right now, in my observation at least, is what if people are willing to have a trade off privacy. In dissent, ultimately the ability to openly dissent for entertainment, essentially, and immediate gratification, which is certainly two biggies that I see places like Amazon, Facebook, Twitter, mm-hmm. any number of these offering. I mean, what does that mean? I mean, people have a choice to do that, I suppose, but.
Yeah.
Yeah, that means modern society.
Well, ultimately means is you have to answer for them the question, what does this matter to me? And you have to demonstrate to them how it can cost them something. And once somebody realizes that not having something is incredibly costing to them, like somebody might not care about freedom of speech right now, but they sure as hell will when they're like slapped in a jail cell and they don't have any access to attorney because that's been taken away. So.
And speaking about that, we also reference the new proposed law in New York. A state law in New York that's being proposed is that anonymous comments, if a complaint has been received, would have to give the real name or be deleted.
Interesting.
Would have to provide the real name of the commenter. The legal name of the commenter. Or the comment be deleted.
How do they verify that? To like upload like IDs because
that's the state law that's been proposed, and the state congressman who presented it said one of the things was that people were being mean about politicians, and he wanted to.
They're the ones that are twittering pictures of their junk. I mean,
people were being mean about politicians. He wanted them to have to stand up behind it with their legal name so that they could be called out for it, or rather, victimized probably.
A private citizen versus a politician, with all the media and bullets versus an everyday person. That's their fight.
Yeah, it's, I mean, of course, I see it differently. Because, I say, this is my choice. I use it for, actually, to make myself more identifiable. I say, there's hundreds of Andrew Nortons. If you can go, there's the Andre Norton Award here at Dragon Con.
Wait, really?
I think so. It's giving away the awards back now. Or something related
that's
to it.
That's kind of cool. Okay.
But I mean, therefore, my name is always going to be associated with Andre, Andrew, one letter different. And so, to Andrew Norton's always going to be hidden when it comes to things like this. But this is always going to be me. There's only one of them, and that's me. And I don't know why, but I've been on Google Plus since literally day one. I've been using this.
Yeah.
Had zero problems. I don't know why, but maybe nobody's complained about me, but that'll be a first.
Let's see.
Have you guys heard about the case where a young woman was shopping online for baby stuff and hadn't told her parents that she was pregnant, and they got the mail saying, oh, you're expecting a kid?
It's a perfect example of your data telling a very detailed picture about you. Like, they found that women who were pregnant would buy unscented lotions, for example, at a certain point, because, like, I guess the scents in the lotion are something that you want to avoid while you're pregnant, because
it makes you nauseous, from what I remember from my wife. But we actually got some baby stuff through from Pampers that started, and I think it's up to, like, your own week, you know, your baby is now 4 years old and three. My youngest is nine, you know. I haven't had a kid like that. They just suddenly started sending and assumed, you know, we were having another kid and sending us stuff. I don't know why. Sometimes it backfires like that.
But statistics never lie. Oh, they send every 18-year-old male child a razor? Wow.
Hi. Hi, Sarah. I'm Suzanne.
Hi.
And I apologize for coming in late to my boyfriend's panel. Kind of awkward. But I went to the wrong hotel. I noticed that you're dressed as Rogue. And since I missed the beginning of the panel, I don't know if you made an introduction about what that means to you, if it has to do with Rogue's powers, like the story of how she stole Carol Danvers' identity and memories and that kind of thing. And I wondered if you would talk about it a little bit in the context of your work.
Yeah, I gave a brief intro, but it's pretty much that the X-Men are a pseudonymous group of mutants, and they all rely on and use pseudonyms a lot. And we know them more for their pseudonyms than for, you know, their real names. Like Logan, I think people know Wolverine, but he's Wolverine. It's not really much deeper than I like this ridiculous color green, and I happen to have these hair extensions, but I think that any X-Men would be a good choice to show pseudonymity, but Rogue in particular is interesting from an identity perspective because she has those absorptive powers.
And we were commenting earlier, I think the book Watchmen really captures a lot of what we're saying, too. It's one of my favorite, I don't know much about comics, but my God, Watchmen just changed my view on it.
It's so good. Everybody should read it.
Let's see, you had a question? Oh, there's a lot. Wow, this is great. There's so many questions.
Pikachu.
Hello.
Lulu. That's okay. I choose you. Go ahead and...
Okay. Anyway, what I'm hearing is that the protections that we take protections like our snail mail is infinitely more protected by law than our email. And I was listening to a tech show a couple weeks ago, and they were saying that one of the problems with getting moon behind it is kind of a cognitive dissonance. Like, why should I care? I have nothing to hide, that general attitude.
Oh,
and
God. I hate that so much. I hate that. I could go on forever, but you're right.
Let's not get started.
That's one of the reasons why created this book, was so that there was at least an easy reference. Somebody could have it, and they'd have a list of arguments and a list of topics.
I was listening to another show, and they were saying about how the video rentals, if anyone, those are protected by law. And what happened was this, there was a debate about it in Congress, this guy. And they were saying that maybe the whole Petraeus thing would be the same tipping point, but it doesn't seem to have been that.
Petraeus had too much baggage behind him, honestly.
Yeah, it's like, ooh, we had an affair. He's not representative of anyone.
By the way, for those, the VHS, the video rental thing, the reason there is a law protecting that is because, was it a congressman or a senator?
Yeah, it was Robert Bork. It was
a Supreme
Video
Court
Privacy
nominee.
Oh, right.
Section Act.
Reagan in 84.
And his data became, I guess, compromised, and he was the one, after that happened to him, he pushed a law through.
Yes.
So really, if we're going on the political route, which it is one of my aspirations here, first policy, then law, is to reach people who actually have, say, standing or influence, and show them why it matters to them. Because once somebody once somebody is passionate about something, it's really not that hard to convince others around them who already know and trust them that an issue is important. And really, it's about taking these ideas and showing people why it matters to them. And unfortunately, people don't have any fundamental common interests except for surviving, basically. So it's difficult to have like some general viewpoint that's going to win everyone over. So instead, talking to people individually or crafting enough narratives. That's why we're doing the Nimrights suspended thing, for example, is because we're creating narratives. These are real people, and this is why they've been suspended, you know, like Judge Judy or something. So ultimately, once you see something you can identify with, then you form that kind of a relationship with it, and you're much more likely to think about it. Yes. Sure.
I've thought of Google and Facebook as particularly egregious in terms of trying to accumulate data and aggregate it. I haven't had quite the same feeling in terms of Amazon and eBay, given that they could get a lot of data. I don't see them as quite as dangerous, and I'm curious about how you feel. But so that's one part of my question. But and how you feel about any other very large providers like that, or assimilators, accumulators. Somehow it seems as though most people don't see them as dangerous. They just voluntarily mm-hmm. give up their data to these places continuously, and especially younger people. Is there a reason for that? Is there a way to change that?
A lot of it's psychology. It's instant gratification. Like, for example, look at the Facebook Connect login, right? You go to a website and it'll say, make a new account, or click this one button and you'll just be automatically logged in with Facebook, right? One of them is so much easier than the others. And people think in terms of what's right in front of them. You know, you think, well, I want to buy this thing on Amazon. It's super convenient. Like, nobody's arguing that. I mean, Amazon is a great site in many cases. But the harms of privacy are slow and steady and creeping, and you don't realize how bad it's gotten because you make these micro decisions. Like, if you look at what Facebook is doing with data now, I mean, just today, they announced another change of their statement of rights and responsibilities, which is, of course, less privacy for you, more data for them. And if you look back at 2004 when they came out, I mean, no one would have ever joined the site. It's these slow, steady, creeping things. And these little micro decisions that we all make because we're lazy. You know, it's hard. Privacy is hard. We used to take it for granted as something that we had by default, but now you have to really work for it. And it's not getting any easier, unfortunately. But eBay, quick point, eBay sells the shit out of your data. They actually have, they will put you as a label. They will label you as like a platinum eBay user or gold or silver or like lower based on how much money you spend, where you spend it. And then they sell that to everybody. I mean, you are a commodity. Like, you are the product being sold. I know that for a fact with eBay because I've done research on that. Yeah, how much chloroform you've bought.
Okay. I'd like to do a real quick little quiz with you all about pseudonyms and pseudonyms. I got a list of eight famous people, eight pseudonyms, and I want to see if you can guess from just their real names, just to see how pervasive the pseudonym is. So we'll start with an easy one. Mark Felt. Anyone know what his famous pseudonym was?
I do, but...
Hmm? Yep, Deep Throat. Good, good, good. All right, how about Illich Ramirez Sanchez?
Carlos the Jackal.
Yep, Carlos the Jackal. Good, good. We're doing well. All right. Paul David Hewson.
Bono.
Yes, Bono. Good.
Wow.
Okay.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Alyssa Zinovieva Rosenbaum.
Oh, God. Really?
Who is it then?
The woman who wrote Atlas Shrugged, I believe.
Yes, Ayn Rand.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep, Alyssa Rosenbaum.
Okay, let's try something a little bit harder. How about Solof Saar? Saloth Saw. Anybody? Kind of famous for killing a lot of people in a country that came up the previous session, in fact. It's Pol Pot.
Ah.
Oh, really? Okay, how about Lucille Francis Ryan? Well, if you go over to the Marriott, you can see it. It's Lucy Lawless. Oh. And Nora Louise Kuzma. She's also at the Marriott. That's Tracy Lords.
Huh.
And one final one. Andreas Cornelius van Hoek. He's been dead a while, but y'all probably know him best as Colonel Tom Parker, Elvis's manager, who used a pseudonym because he refused to admit he was Dutch. That's why Elvis never left the U.S., never toured internationally, because Colonel Tom was Dutch but was pretending to be American. And so he had no American passport and could not leave the U.S., not without revealing he was Dutch. And here we have why we have pseudonyms.
Reminds me of
the most powerful singer ever still had to stay and keep that singer locked up because he was afraid of his pseudonym.
Reminds me of Andy Kaufman and Tony Clifton. So,
yeah.
But
anyway.
So a couple of them you knew, some of them you knew, and some of them you didn't.
Oh, you had a question? Or did you just pass it on?
Where's the mic?
Oh, okay. Hopefully we answer. Oh, okay.
I don't mean to suggest through this question, the other question that I asked, that I am in any way against this movement, because I'm not. I'm fully in support of it. But we haven't talked about the negative aspects of anonymity, whether it's cyberbullying or the cesspool that is 4chan or all sorts of...
Come on,
of
say it. Say pedophiles. Come
I'm
on.
I'm not going to say it because I heard you mention it at the beginning of the you know, before the panel. But I do think that it bears mentioning that anonymity is not a purely good thing. And I was just wondering if you can speak to that in any sense and any potential safeguards that may, you know, be out there for that sort of thing.
Well, I know from my experience, one of the things I do is in my day job is I also lead the comment moderation at a site called Torrent Freak. And we get hundreds of comments a day, and most of them are using pseudonyms, and often they'll try and copy one another's pseudonyms to try and pretend they're one another. There's some that are pro MPAA and so on. People will try and copy them, and they get really bad. And I have to read every single one of them.
This is good to know. I should write a script and flood it with
yeah, it is horrible to read.
Like the Matrix script or something, I don't know.
I think the aspect of cyberbullying, and that's, again, back to this New York law, is, you know, the other aspect given was cyberbullying as well as people are mean to politicians. Boo-hoo-hoo. But the actual impact of cyberbullying really isn't as big as it's made out to be, from what I've seen. It's mostly an overblown thing by helicopter parents. You know, oh no, my kid who's been locked away in his room that, you know, has no human contact is suddenly bullied by these things. Yeah, because you're a terrible parent. Stop blaming it on the cyberbullying. Blame it on yourself.
Yeah, and I could add to that too. I've read quite a few studies about cyberbullying, and I have found no direct correlation between somebody using a pseudonym or a nym online and becoming a cyberbully. I like to remind everyone that before we had cyberbullies, we had bullies. And while it may be true that a pseudonym may enhance somebody's ability to be a cyberbully, it may also enhance their ability to say things that are very productive. So it's effectively a tool, and if you try to do a blanket ban on it, like they try to do with a number of cases, like with Anonymous and with comments. If you force like Facebook names on people for comments and such, TechCrunch tried to do that, and they saw the numbers of their comments diminish to 10% of what they originally were.
It was terrible, and then it went back to...
Right. Mm-hmm. So I have not seen... I've seen a lot of studies that try to hint at it, but I've not actually seen any statistical correlation between using NIMS and cyberbullying. Although I've seen a lot of people try to make the case.
Like the Ask FM? Was it Ask FM?
I think so.
Where they was claiming, this girl committed suicide because of cyberbullying, and it turned out 98% of the...
Was that the Amanda
messages.
Todd thing? Because Amanda Todd had that... Yeah. Amanda Todd, all of her cyberbullies were Facebook, which actually has a real names policy.
And so this Ask FM one, they found that 98% or something of the abusive messages actually came from the same IP that she was using.
Right. That's actually an interesting thing. I just want to jump in. I saw this in one of the papers that I was reading. The notion of anonymous self-harm, I find it really fascinating. People who actually post anonymous comments online to themselves that are like antagonistic to get attention. And I don't actually know if that's anonymous because they know who it is. It's just it appears. It's an interesting dynamic, but I just wanted to put that one out there. Yeah.
Yeah, we had a whole panel on that earlier on. That was
Is that the Aaron Swartz thing?
Yeah.
That's the FAA.
That was MIT and a few. Oh God, there's so many problems with that.
Yeah, it's fucking.
Oh, okay. We have another question. Oh,
okay, so I get the feeling that there's a lot of people here who are at least of a partially, shall we say, I'm having a vocabulary failure here. Activist sort of bent, and that's kind of why we're here. Okay, so I want to provide some ammunition that hopefully people can use.
Can you speak into the mic more?
Oh, sorry. Because you were talking about terrorists and pedophiles are the two
catchphrases of the apocalypse.
Infopocalypse.
Exactly.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So if you can blame anything on or use either of those as impetus for legislation, then you can get just about anything passed.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I can't speak about terrorists in particular. I don't have a lot of experience with them. But I can give you one example about the pedophile argument, but I don't want to be that guy and talk about this stuff because I know it's like a major trigger point. So if this stuff freaks anybody out, no, okay. So personal situation here. I was online a couple of years ago. My name is Dan. It's not the most common name in the world, but there's certainly enough of us out there, and I'm enough of a dweeb that I will try to get that as like a handle on a site and stuff. And if I'm there early enough, sometimes I will. So I was on a site doing some, just miscellaneous technical crap, and somebody sent me child pornography. Mm. And I just, at first I was shocked, and then I was nauseated, and then I was angry. And when I finally got control of my emotions, being a systems engineer, I said, I must find this person and destroy him. So I did that. I went through and very methodically, I found his IP address, I pulled his ISP information, I, found the channels he was subscribed to, all that sort of stuff. And then I did the research part. And first I called the FBI, and I got to the duty office, and they hooked me up with... Long story short, I had to go through customs because this person turned out to be a Canadian. And I probably spent about 18 hours just in the process of getting a hold of people, getting the information on a floppy disk. This was a while ago. I didn't want to actually have to pull a hard drive and give it to the... So I got a person from customs to accept this evidence, and it went nowhere. They were absolutely not interested in tracking this guy down. Now, bear in mind, I had his name, I had his IP address, I had timestamps of everything. Just go to his ISP, pull his address, drive to his house, and arrest the guy. This is not rocket science. No one was interested in doing anything with this. Okay? So when they tell you, we have to have these laws because we're protecting the children from these pedophiles, they're full of shit. They don't really care about protecting the kids from the pedophiles. It's all an excuse. If they really cared, they would actually be out there doing something about it. And if you think that's a bad example, I've got another one. I won't get into all the background and stuff, but it was that plus, oh, by the way, we also have his address and his credit card information because a friend of mine was a web host and, yada, yada. The FBI said, can you give us a physical description? And my buddy Howie's like, are you kidding me? I've never seen this guy, and I don't want to see this guy. I can't give you a physical description. Well, without a physical description, we can't go arrest him. You have his address. Here's a credit card. I mean, what else do you need?
That's crazy.
And anytime they tell you that they're doing this to try to protect pedophiles, to go after pedophiles, it's all total BS.
I want to also add in that I get the pedophile question all the time about can't they be used to protect pedophiles and such. And it's easy to actually flip that around and say, well, yes, but if a kid is being stalked, that child can also use a pseudonym online to protect themselves from the pedophile. So it works both ways.
Okay, yeah, about the terrorism thing.
Question. Oh, one last question. Okay. Yeah,
that's also bullshit because the United States is the number one fiscal sponsor of international terrorism in the world. So that's another bullshit one to say,
Yeah. Those two things come up a lot. And as Pikachu guy said before, people will say, well, terrorism, pedophiles, and also, I have nothing to hide, which every time that I hear that, you can just turn it around on people really easily and say, well, it's not about what you have to hide, but what you have to live for. Like, if you like expressing yourself in any fashion, you should care about privacy, because if you know that people are watching you, you're going to change your behavior. You're not going to say the same stuff. You're going to be afraid of maybe repercussions in the future. Will this hurt my ability to get a job or a date or whatever? We need privacy to live the kind of life that we want to live in America. You know, like, we should have the freedom and choice to do that. And plus, everybody has fucking something to hide. Like, could I look at your cell phone pictures right now and just scroll through them? Like, could I stand there while you're on the toilet? You know, you have stuff to hide, and that's okay.
Some people are
into that. Makes you an interesting and complex person. And there's nothing wrong with that.
And I also want to add to that two things. First, the notion of whether you have something or to hide or not, the question is who actually makes that decision. And that's actually one of the big things with Bill Binney, one of the NSA whistleblowers, has said. The other is that when you say, well, I don't have anything to hide, I'm not doing anything wrong, that's actually the logical fallacy of the false dilemma, which shows that you only have two options. You're either with us or with the bad guys. And I just want to throw that out there so people can research it or use that. It's a logical fallacy. So. Yes, my friend did that talk. He is a troll.
All right quickly.
Yeah, I know we're kind of butting right up against the next panel, so I don't want to take up
Aren't
too much time.
Aren't you on the
time.
Next panel? Oh, okay.
But I think a lot of times people forget about a lot of the passive data collection that's done that isn't even you actively giving up information to any one entity. I actually work for a local government, and I won't go into which one. But I work in the IT department, and we, as just a fairly small local government, in every government building have free Wi-Fi. You know, and the instant you walk into the building, if your phone is turned to just find Wi-Fi hotspots, even if it doesn't automatically connect to them, it just detects that they're there. The system detects that you also are there. It's advanced enough that I can look at the system and see a heat map of every single person who's walking around the building, what kind of phone they have. If they're connected to the system, I can see more metadata from their phone. And this is information that people don't even know. It's not even on the page that you have to agree to when you connect to the Wi-Fi, because you don't have to connect to the Wi-Fi in order to give up the data. So, I mean, nobody thinks about it, and it's a small local government. If we have that,
yeah.
Oh, there are already companies that do that in grocery stores too.
Oh yeah, I mean, that's like the next big thing in advertising. Is like Home Depot does this, for example, tracking where you go based on, you know, your phone's in your pocket, but also these little tiny cameras that are installed in the shelves themselves, which use facial detection to see. Okay, are you looking at this shelf for how long? What are your basic demographics? Are you male, female, how old? What is your shopping pattern that you use as you go throughout the store? And there's actually an interesting Kickstarter project that I backed and just got funded called Off Pocket that deals exactly with this, where you get your phone, put it in this little sleeve, and it, in theory, blocks all those kinds of passive transmissions without killing your battery. So I'm really interested to see how that turns out. Yeah.
What was it called?
Off pocket.
Off pocket.
Yeah.
So if you're doing it with Wi-Fi, why aren't you doing it with a cell repeater as well?
What do you mean?
So like AT&T, for one, will hand out micro cells, but you can do a generic GSM CDMA repeater inside the building. You can do a bunch of micro points and track people through cell signal. So even if they turn off Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, you still have a way.
It's not. I'm guessing it's not about the point of actually tracking it, but that's a side effect of the.
That's a side effect of the system. It was never our intention, or at least I'm not the network administrator, but that was the intention of the network administrator to track people. But that is a feature provided by the vendor of the equipment.
Yeah, we added spying.
So we should probably wrap up here.
Yeah, we should.
Okay, so is this one last question, or do you get it?
No.
That was it. Oh.
We're at the end,
so we can we'll be wandering around. I'm normally not that hard to spot, but this is Dragon Con, so it's a little different. If you go to @vat on Twitter, you can find me. I'm also aesthetics at aesthetics.com, and also if you go to nimrights.org and join the mailing list, you can keep in touch. So
and these are all linked up as well from profiles are all linked from the panel page on the EFF forums website, which is eff.dragoncon.org.
Yep.
And you'll find the schedule with the panel pages.
All right, and I think we're getting kicked off. So thanks so much for having us. Yeah.